Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a deep dive conversation about one advocate's quest to change the way we approach drug users and the opioid crisis. And we get some good water news for a change. But first, primary election day is nearly upon us, and now campaign finance reports are giving us a sense of where the money is going and who's behind it. And that's drawing a lot of attention in at least one Democratic primary that's becoming more contentious by the day. In CD3, which includes most of South Phoenix, West Phoenix, and downtown, there are two major candidates left duking it out after a crowded start to the race. Raquel Teran is a former state lawmaker and former head of the Arizona Democratic Party, and Yasemin Ansari is a former Phoenix City Council member. Pediatrician Dwayne Wooten is also running in the primary. Outside money is pouring into this race, and it's causing some finger-pointing among the candidates. And KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk is here to tell us more. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with this outside money that is, you know, raising some eyebrows here. We're talking about more than $1 million, kind of late in the game, from a PAC called Protect Progress going to Yasemin Ansari's campaign. Why is this getting so much attention?
Well, for one thing, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But for another thing, there's this criticism from Tehran against Ansari for taking that money because that PAC has the interests of cryptocurrency in mind and is apparently funded by some billionaires in the tech industry who are also apparently supporting Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's saying, you know, it's suspicious that Ansari, who's a Democrat and progressive Democrat, is accepting money from a group that might also support Republicans. And it's, you know, suspicious.
Right. There are some tech billionaires that have partially funded this PAC, right, that also support Donald Trump.
Right. And but I wonder, for voters in that district, are they going to, first of all, hear about this? And second of all, are they going to care that a candidate took money from a place that has people who maybe support another person that they might not like? You know, I think it might be a few degrees of separation too many.
All right. Is Tehran also getting outside money here?
Yeah, Tehran's doing pretty well in fundraising, and I think she was beating Ansari before this most recent quarter reports came in, and now they're back on an even-ish playing field with Ansari, I think, just a little tiny bit ahead fundraising-wise.
Right. Did we, from the beginning, Cameron, like, expect this to be a tight race? Who came in with the advantage?
You know, for myself personally, when I heard that Tehran was jumping in, I thought that she would have a pretty clear advantage. She has all this long, impressive history, right? She was an activist in the SB 1070 era. She comes from Douglas, and she worked very hard against Russell Pierce and Joe Arpaio.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, she was the head of the Arizona Democratic State Party and touts the win in 2020 when they got Biden elected. And then from there, she was in the state legislature and served in a leadership role there. So that's, you know, that's quite a resume. Nobody else has that.
Yeah.
But Ansari is not to be discounted. And she's sort of proven that throughout this whole race. You know, she was vice mayor of Phoenix. And since this district is so small, it really is Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not small potatoes.
Yeah, yeah. Good name recognition, it sounds like, for both of these candidates. But they have very different styles, very different approaches to campaigning.
Yeah, and it's funny because I would say in a lot of ways they're very similar. but, you know, I would say one thing Ansari is doing and has been able to do that Tehran maybe hasn't is say that she was able to accomplish a lot of what she set out to do on the Phoenix City Council because the state legislature is Republican-controlled. So, you know, as a Democratic state lawmaker, Raquel Teran maybe couldn't get as much of her policy through. Like, she wasn't passing bills left and right that actually got signed into law.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Ansari can say, here, you know, I cared about homelessness or heat relief, and I actually did it.
Yeah, city level stuff is definitely different on that front. So this is a race that's super visible. If you're driving around Phoenix, you are seeing these signs everywhere. There are ads on television. How does this all kind of play into the broader funding pictures for these candidates? Are they both raising a lot of money?
Yeah, they're both raising a lot of money, and money is definitely a factor. I mean, it's not a guarantee that you can buy your way into Congress, of course, but, you know, money definitely helps, especially with things like ad campaigns. It's very much about how you spend the money, if you're strategic with your fundraising.
Yeah. And we're seeing a lot of heads, that's for sure. Talk little bit about this district. We mentioned it's South Phoenix, West Phoenix, downtown. Mm-hmm. It's a heavily Latino district.
It is. And that's something else that Tehran has really leaned into. She's a Latina woman and she's saying that, you know, that should help her. She's been in the community for a very long time. Ansari doesn't have that. She's Iranian. And she's saying that, you know, she has the support of the Iranian community, but that's not as big of a community in Phoenix. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So last minute here, let me ask you about some other tight congressional races or others that you're watching for here. As we're heading into primary day, where are you looking?
Well, besides CD3's primary, I'm thinking CD1, which I believe is the Schweikert district. And there's quite a few people in that race. And then the other one would be CD8, which I believe is Debbie Lesko's district. And Lesko is not going to be returning. So there's a whole bunch of Republicans there. And I'm curious to see who emerges as the front runner in both of those races, both in the CD1 Democratic primary and in the CD8 Republican primary. And talk about money. That's a lot of money in both of those races.
A lot of money in both of those races. A lot of names people might recognize. Who do you think might come out on top here?
Well, in CD8, I think name recognition-wise and money-wise, you're going to want to pay attention to Ben Thoma, Abe Hamadeh, and Blake Masters. Mm-hmm. Masters and Hamadeh were both Trump-endorsed last time in 2022. Now Hamadeh is the only one who kept that Trump endorsement, but they're both well-known for that reason. And then Thoma was the Speaker of the House as recently as this past legislative session. So he's not coming from the so-called MAGA crowd, but he has been in the district for a long time.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Lots to watch for as we roll into primary election day next week. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk. Cameron, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
With all of the bad news about the state of water in Arizona, let's turn now to a little good water news. Lake Powell, one of the region's largest reservoirs, is at its highest level in more than 3 years. This, even though this year's runoff will be below average. The lake is now 42% full, nearly 20% higher than it was last spring, and out of danger of falling so low it would hit so-called Deadpool and not be able to generate electricity at Glen Canyon Dam. Longtime Arizona environmental reporter Tony Davis is covering the story for the Arizona Daily Star, and he joins us now to talk more about it. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Okay, so start with some details here. Like 42% full doesn't really sound great, I gotta say, but it's way up, it sounds like, from where we were just a year ago.
Yeah, a year ago it was as low as 23% full. And then in this winter and spring of 2023, there was this enormous amount of snow up in the upper basin in the Colorado Rockies and in the headwaters. So instead of the usual, we've been getting 50, 60, 80% of normal runoff. And last year was 166% of normal. And then this year, the runoff was only 84% of normal. But because there was a lot of water conservation that the lower basin states did, it's of Arizona, California, and Nevada, between them agreed to save 1 million acre feet of water a year last year. And so they started the conservation this past year. And that pushed the lake up further, even though the total runoff this year was below normal. Mm-hmm. Then in June, the precipitation in the upper basin was 150% of normal. And that by itself pushed the lake up another 4 feet. So now it's like 60 feet higher than it was a year ago. And that's pretty amazing.
So that is pretty amazing. So it sounds like we got some good weather here. We got some good luck, right? But we also can thank ourselves in a way. Like you mentioned, significant cutbacks from water users. Give us a little more detail on that. What did we all do?
Well, like here in Tucson, the city agreed to leave something like 50,000 acre feet in Lake Mead in the past year. And this year they're going to leave 30,000 acre feet. And I know Phoenix was taking similar measures. And a lot of other cities in central Arizona also agreed to leave some water in Lake Mead, and they were all compensated for it. You know, there was hundreds of millions of dollars spent by the Bureau of Reclamation to compensate all these cities for giving up water. And of course, I don't know how long they're going to be able to come up with that kind of money, but that's what's working for now.
So, I mean, let's just back up for a second and just get a sense of how unbelievable this is in a way, right? Like last year at this time, we were talking about Deadpool. Like we were worried that the levels in this lake would get so low that we could not even generate power. This is a huge shift.
Yeah, I guess I would say that right now it appears that the river's runoff and the precipitation have become very, very volatile because the lake had dropped like 50 or 60 feet from 2021 to 2023, and now it went back up another 60 feet this past year, I should say. And that could happen again. I mean, we're not out of the woods. It doesn't mean that everything is going to be great, because overall, the climate appears to be changing. And overall, over 20 years, the runoff is declining. This last year was really excellent. And if we could get weather like this every year, we wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah.
But there's no guarantee that's going to happen. And in fact, that's not what's happened in the past.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what this means going forward. We're right now no longer in danger of Deadpool, like at least at this point. But does this also mean that we're not as likely to see cutbacks in water deliveries of the reservoir? Like, are those conservation measures that you talked about in the major cities here in Phoenix and Tucson going to have to continue to keep this going?
Well, yeah, the three lower basin states have agreed to save 1 million acre feet a year for 3 years. And that, according to the Bureau of Reclamation, will keep the system whole until like 2026. And for the longer term, there's going to have to be more conservation measures, or at least more plans to institute conservation measures if the lake keeps falling. You know, the idea is to have a system in place that can respond quickly when the runoff gets low again and both Lake Mead and Lake Powell start dropping.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be immediate cutbacks, but they'd have the system in place to do these cutbacks when they're necessary. It would just be able to respond faster and have more flexibility.
Yeah. So long term, we're not really out of danger for good here because things are, as you say, so volatile.
That is correct.
You're also talking about the effects, though, on the lake. There's economic impacts up at Lake Powell, like recreational activities are back up and running now that were not last summer because of this, right?
That is correct. Some of the marinas that shut down are now running again, although there's still a number of them that are still shut down. There was a ferry that took people from the Halls Crossing Marina to the Bullfrog Marina at the east end of the lake. It was shut down for 3 years. But it reopened this month, although that was when the lake was at like 3,583 feet. When it goes back below 3,575, they can't keep it open. For right now, though, it's open.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about forecasts for next year, then. I mean, like, at least in the near term, it sounds like we're out of some immediate danger, not long term, obviously. What does the forecast look like next year? Might this good trend continue?
Well, the Bureau of Reclamation issues forecasts every month, and they look 2 years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And the current forecast is for Lake Powell to go down in the fall and then next year to come back up. And it would actually be a little higher next year than it is now. But that assumes average precipitation and average runoff. And a lot of years, we don't get average precipitation and average runoff.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a lot more or a lot less. And in fact, it's almost never average. So I take those forecasts with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Yeah, absolutely. Last question for you, Tony. I mean, looking at this as a little piece of good water news, right? Like, what would it take in terms of conservation, because we can't control the weather, right, going forward, to ensure that we get some more good news on Lake Powell and these major reservoirs in the future? What kind of cutbacks would we have to see?
Well, they have to be prepared to cut back at least as much as what we've already cut back so far. You know, there's a structural deficit on the river of, we're using about 1.2 million acre feet a year more routinely than what's actually there. And so they have to cut that back at a minimum. And then they're probably going to end up having to cut back more if necessary. It's a matter of getting plans in place to be prepared. You hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And that's what they're trying to do.
All right, we will leave it there. That is Tony Davis, environmental reporter for the Arizona Daily Star, joining us with a little bit of good-ish water news. Tony, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it as always.
All right, thanks.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, even though burros are not native to Arizona, they've been thriving in the Grand Canyon for more than a century. And there's a hot debate over whether or not we should let them stay there.
The first director of the park, Stephen Mather, he in 1920 called the burros evil and called for their removal pretty much immediately.
Why the public's opinion of these little donkeys has changed over time. But first, as the opioid crisis in Arizona has gotten worse, the conversation around how to address it has changed. It used to be that lawmakers would push for stricter punishments for drug users for their paraphernalia and, in many ways, their very existence. Now, there's still talk of punishment, but it's more focused on dealers and traffickers. And there's a lot more talk about protecting the lives of drug users from overdoses, with needle exchanges, fentanyl test strips, and more. And a lot of that change has to do with the work done by our next guest. Haley Coles has been the executive director of Sonoran Prevention Works for 14 years, working in harm reduction for drug users in Arizona. She's lobbied at the legislature, grown networks of advocates statewide, and she's done it all while recognizing that drug users are human beings, because she was one. She's stepping down this summer, and I sat down with her recently to talk more about why and her own story that led her there. And it's today's Deep Dive.
I was a teenager and I found myself really struggling with depression and my mental health, and heroin was a really good balm for that. I really think that heroin actually saved my life. It made the pain of living tolerable enough. I do think that, you know, for me personally, the pain of living was too much. And so that's what I turned to, one of the things that I turned to. And I became dependent on heroin pretty quickly. I tried to stop a lot of times and I wasn't able to stop. This was a different time. Fentanyl was not in the drug supply. Mm-hmm. The heroin was relatively consistent and predictable. And I found myself sharing syringes. And I knew very well that it was dangerous to share syringes. I knew young people my age, who had hepatitis C, who had HIV. And I did everything in my power to not share syringes. Mm-hmm. But it was incredibly difficult to obtain sterile syringes.
So, I mean, 20 years ago when you're a teenager, right? But take us back to a little bit of what that was like in your mind. Like you said, it saved your life in some ways, but it's also so dangerous in others. What was it like when you tried to stop?
I mean, it was demoralizing. In my head, I wanted to stop, and another part of my head didn't want to stop. And that was so much of the challenge for me was, you know, I had this physical dependency that was very difficult to get through. And I would go through detox and withdrawals. I did that probably a dozen times. I would get through it. And then I'd say, okay, I'm only going to use, you know, every 3 days, so I won't become dependent. And by the end of the first day, I had already used 4 or 5 times. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't stop. So, yeah, it was hard to have my mind kind of at war with what I wanted. The things that were really important to me became less important. Mm. And I found myself in some really dangerous relationships and dangerous situations. And, you know, I was really fixated on one thing, which was getting high and feeling better. Yeah. I felt normal when I was high, and I felt not okay when I wasn't high.
What did it do to your life? School, family, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I dropped out of school. I did go get my GED and I started at ASU early. But the great thing about that is I could go to class and then I could sleep in the library for 4 hours, and then I'd go to another class and I'd meet with my dealer and then I'd go to another class. Mm. So that worked for me for a little while. And then I started dropping my classes in college. You know, I had these dreams about going to New York University, and I wanted to be an actress. And, you know, I stopped doing theater. I didn't even bother applying to out-of-state colleges. I had a job that I was just the worst employee ever. So you know, I don't have the same kind of story as a lot of other people do because I was so young and I didn't have that much to lose.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the things that I hoped for just weren't important to me anymore.
Yeah. How'd you get out of it?
Through medical and therapeutic intervention.
Mm-hmm.
My parents didn't know.
Mm.
And I told them and I ended up in detox the next day.
Mm.
And, you know, in my head, I was going to go to detox. I was going to get it out of my system and then maybe go to meetings, maybe get on medication and I'd be fine. But since I was underage, once I was institutionalized, my parents wanted to keep me institutionalized. And so I was in treatment for almost a year.
Wow.
I didn't want to be there, but I didn't really have much of a say. And I was on medications for opioid use disorder.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that those also saved my life. I was in therapy. I did 12-step. I did a lot of things. And I know that I also had an incredible amount of privilege where I didn't have kids that I was taking care of. I didn't have a career that was at stake. I didn't have housing that I had to figure out how to pay for. I didn't have legal troubles. So I do think that so much of that positioning and that privilege really helped me
mm-hmm.
with being able to do what I wanted to do, which was to stop using at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it took a lot of things. It took a lot of support from a lot of people.
And a long time, it sounds like.
And a long time. I tried stopping a dozen times. I went through detox over and over and over again, got it out of my system, and I wasn't able to stop.
Wow. Okay, so you do stop eventually. You spend a long time working at that and making it happen, it sounds like. You get out, and eventually you start working with people in the same situation, right? Which would be, I'm imagining, rewarding in some ways, but also probably really difficult in others. Talk about the process of founding Sonoran Prevention Works and wanting to do this kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, as cliche as it sounds, it really has always been a labor of love. As challenging as it's been, it's never felt hard because it was so important to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 2010, myself and two friends who had all kind of been in the same situation. We'd all shared needles. We'd all seen people overdose. Some of my colleagues had overdosed themselves.
Hmm.
We wondered why on earth there wasn't a needle exchange in Phoenix, which is one of the largest cities in the country, where there are needle exchanges all over the country in mm-hmm. every other major city. And we started looking into the laws, and we saw that distributing syringes is a Class 6 felony. It was a Class 6 felony. We saw that Sheriff Arpaio had said that if he caught anybody distributing syringes, he would personally arrest them.
Hmm.
You know, so this was information that we didn't have before and we had. And we said, okay, well, we better be careful. And we got this teeny tiny grant from out of state for $1,200. And we used that to buy a whole bunch of syringes and cotton and cookers and alcohol wipes and all the things that people need for safer injection.
Mm-hmm.
And we started riding our bikes around downtown Phoenix. And we were afraid that Sheriff Arpaio was going to personally arrest us.
Wow.
So we would put the syringes in like McDonald's cups and bags. And walk around parks and interact with people and, you know, tell them what we had. And they were freaked out, too, because to be a person who uses drugs and to be in public, you're at constant risk.
Yeah.
Right. And so it took some time to build relationships and to build trust. But eventually, you know, we started delivering syringes all over the valley. We started doing outreach at certain locations that would allow us to do that. And that was really the first step, was getting the supplies out there. But we knew at the same time we had to change culture and we had to change laws.
Yeah.
Because it shouldn't be three ragtag, you know, former IV drug users breaking the law to distribute syringes on bicycles. This is a proven decades-long public health intervention. And so it was kind of us doing both of those things at the same time, doing the underground while doing the above ground culture changing work.
So you started lobbying, essentially, right? You get involved in lawmaking, if in the legislature, a place where you've spent a lot of time now, I'm guessing. Did you ever imagine yourself there? What was that like?
Oh, no, never. But, you know, I've kind of always done the things that nobody else wants to do. So I was happy to put myself in that position. It was fine for me. You know, when I was younger, I wanted to be an actress. And when I was in college, I studied creative writing. And honestly, I felt like I was kind of able to meld those things along with my personal experience when talking to legislators, you know, finding creative ways of speaking to their values while still being honest about my values and honest about what was needed. Yeah, I definitely had to have some really hard conversations where policymakers, you know, basically told me that people like me shouldn't be alive, that people like me deserve to die for our decisions when, you know, what I know is that it's not the choices you make, it's the choices you have. But, you know, my work at the legislature, I feel so proud of it because year after year going down there, eventually it made a difference and we were able to legalize needle exchange programs as well as fentanyl test strips.
Let's talk about the approach that Sonoran Prevention Works has taken, because as you're saying, they're like, it's pretty radical, especially in a conservative state at a conservative legislature dealing with lawmakers who probably think about drug use very differently. Your mission is, the slogan is building a healthy Arizona with people who use drugs, right? Like, so you're asking people to take a different approach to think about people who use drugs differently and think about what that means a little differently. Talk a little bit about first just what that is and the sort of mind shift you're trying to explain to folks.
So we use a theory called harm reduction. And it's similar to wearing a seatbelt when you're driving. Driving a car is very dangerous. We don't say don't drive a car. We say wear a seatbelt, get a Volvo, put in airbags. And so it's that same approach with drug use where we're not saying don't use drugs. We're saying that's the choice that you're choosing to make. There are things that can be done so that you can be safer, right, despite making that choice. I think that so many organizations who work in the substance use field really view people who use drugs as helpless and hopeless and sick. And the reality is that all of us use drugs. Some of them are legal. Some of them used to be legal. Some of them used to be illegal. I think it's helpful to humanize drug use and people who use drugs. Everybody has a different reason for why they're using. And so first and foremost, we have to humanize people. We have to understand that we are all part of families and communities that are devastated when we become sick and when we die of preventable deaths. And so our approach is acknowledging that drug use happens, that it's real, that human beings have used drugs since the beginning of time, that we will never live in a drug-free world, and that we can work with people to make positive change, whatever that positive change may be. Some people want to stop and they need help getting childcare. They need help being able to pay for their apartment while they're in treatment. There are other people who don't want to stop using and don't see any reason to stop using, but maybe they want to change the way they use. Maybe they don't want to use needles anymore. There are ways that we can support that. Maybe they want to use less frequently. Maybe they don't want to use when their kids are around. There's just this wide array of options that our society doesn't typically consider. You know, it's either you're using drugs and you're going to get sick and die alone, or you're not using drugs and there's really no in between. But in reality, there is. And that's what our organization tries to do, is to meet people exactly where they are and build people up, give people choices so that they actually have choices and actually have options for being safer and happier.
Right. I mean, bring us into some of those conversations you've had with lawmakers who probably saw this very differently, because the law comes into play here for them, right? Like, you're going to hear a lot of people say, well, you know, this is illegal. We cannot support this. We cannot support people who do this or help them do it in any way. How do you approach those conversations?
First off, laws change all the time. What was illegal 15 years ago might be legal today, and what was legal 15 years ago might be illegal today. So I think also understanding that we are creating criminality. You know, people who use drugs aren't inherently bad people. They aren't inherently criminals. But when you create laws that say that drug use is a criminal offense, then you are creating a criminal out of a person. But, you know, unfortunately, lawmakers didn't start listening until we were in the middle of the worst overdose crisis that we've seen by the numbers. You know, and with some of the policies that we were pushing for a very long time, there were a lot of other policies that were introduced that just didn't work. right? The Arizona Opioid Epidemic Act of 2018. We had been pushing for legalized syringe service programs for years before that. And they kept saying no. And they kept saying, we're going to do this instead. And by the time we were able to get the syringe service program law passed in 2021, we said, you guys already tried. You've tried a lot of different things. They weren't evidence-based to begin with. You didn't consult people who use drugs and their families. And we've seen now over a few years that it really didn't work and that things have gotten even worse. So really, it's those personal stories that have made the biggest impact. Mm. And so whether it was my personal story, whether it was bringing in constituents who had personal connections or parents who had lost their kids, that was what really spoke to people, being able to understand that that it's whole entire families and communities who are affected by preventable death. So while we weren't able to, you know, get lawmakers to get on board with decriminalizing drug use, we were able to get quite a bit of support in understanding these are the decisions people make, whether you like it or not. And mm-hmm. there are tangible, inexpensive, easy solutions to keep people alive and to keep people healthy.
How did naloxone change this conversation? I'm imagining it sort of dropped a maybe good bomb into the middle of it, right?
Oh, huge. Yeah. So, you know, naloxone had been around since, I think, the 60s or the 70s for a very long time, and it was only used by emergency medical personnel. Mm-hmm. In the 90s in Chicago, there was a needle exchange program called Chicago Recovery Alliance that got their hands on naloxone and started distributing it to their participants, to people who use drugs. Mm-hmm. And dozens and then hundreds and then thousands of people were using naloxone to save people's lives without calling 911, without going to the hospital. And we know that because there are criminal penalties, a lot of people who are using are really afraid to call 911, and for good reason. So in 2012, when we were distributing our syringes and McDonald's cups, we had some friends from out of state who sent us naloxone. Hmm. And it was illegal in Arizona at the time to be doing it without prescription, to be distributing it without a medical professional there, without prescription. That was not legal.
Sure.
And we did it anyways because people's lives depended on it and because it was safe and it was the right thing to do. And we started hearing those reports of overdose reversals and lives saved. And so in 2015, on a larger scale, when, you know, the health department and policymakers started talking about naloxone in Arizona, we said, hi, we've already been doing this. We've been doing it for years and it's been working. It did, unfortunately, take 2 years at the legislature to get naloxone access expanded to all lay people, but it happened. Yeah. And it's been incredible. We've distributed over 1 million doses of naloxone. We've had nearly 30,000 lives saved as a result. And that was all because of, you know, community organizing and people who use drugs themselves saying, this is what we need and we're going to go and get it. And, you know, I think we're pretty past the concerns that people used to have of, oh, if there's naloxone around, then people will feel safer pushing it to the edge and using and potentially overdosing. And mm-hmm. I mean, study after study has shown that that's not true. And if you just use common sense, you know, if a person overdoses and then they are hit with naloxone, they're not high anymore. They're very sick. They've basically wasted whatever money they used to get high. It's a horrible experience to wake up from an overdose after receiving naloxone. Mm. So that's really not an actual concern. It's not a reality. But there has been so much emphasis on opioid overdose and not enough on stimulant overdose. And we're seeing, and we've been saying this for a long time, and the data is showing it, that people are overdosing more and more and dying from stimulants. And there is unfortunately not a naloxone for stimulants.
Stimulants like what?
Like meth and like cocaine.
Sure. Okay. So let's talk then about what comes next here, because we're talking to you now about the work that you've done here for a long time and the important work you've done, but you're leaving, right? This is the last couple of weeks of this job for you. And you're not leaving Phoenix, I understand, but talk a little bit about why and what's next for you.
Yeah, I've known for a long time that I wasn't going to do this forever mm-hmm. and how important it is to have leadership from other people. From a lot of different people. You know, I never wanted this movement or this work to be dependent on one person. And so for years, I've been working to bring more and more people in. Our organization has trained thousands and thousands of people on harm reduction, how to implement it. We've got 40 incredible staff who deeply believe in and understand harm reduction. And, you know, not many people get to say that they accomplished their dreams. And I have. It was my dream to legalize syringe service programs. And I did that, and it happened. And that doesn't mean that there's not more work to do. There's still so much more work to do. And it doesn't have to be me.
Good luck in what is next for you. That is outgoing Executive Director of Sonoran Prevention Works, Haley Coles. Haley, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. For a lot of people, when they think about the Grand Canyon, they may think about the views, the Colorado River at the bottom, or the layers of rock between the rim and the river. But lots of people also think about the wildlife, including burros. The animals are not native to the Grand Canyon and have a complicated history with the park and the region. Abby Harlow has studied and written about this. She is a PhD candidate in ASU School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies. Her dissertation is on the historical use and cultural significance of burros and mules in the American West. She spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, who asked how burros got to the Grand Canyon in the first place.
So burros were introduced to North America by Spanish conquistadors, we believe about the 1500s, and their population stayed pretty small for a long time until prospectors started coming into the canyon. And they always, just as we picture them, were accompanied with their little burro companion. And they soon found out that the canyon was not as hospitable and as rich in gold as they originally thought. And many of them either abandoned their burrows in the canyon or the burro got away from them. And so while the prospectors left, the burro stayed and they did very well in the canyon.
What is it about that area that seems so habitable for them?
Well, so the burros that were brought over evolved in North Africa in the desert, and they're really well suited to our desert climate because it's pretty similar. Not a lot of grass, but they do well on eating desert shrubs and do well without a lot of water. And so the burros just did what they were evolved to do and subsisted on in the desert and seemed to do very well.
What kind of impact did their presence have on native species, either other animals or plants, you know, once their numbers really started multiplying?
So that's the ultimate question, right? That's been debated on whether burros should stay or not is what are they doing to the environment? And a lot of the reason for the call for removal in the 20th century was claims of burros kind of eroding soil, compacting soil, ruining trails. Burrows tend to, because there isn't a lot of water, they dig water holes. And the main concern, as always in the desert with limited forage, was the competition that burrows have directly with bighorn sheep. They eat the same stuff. So burrows tend to be bigger, a little more aggressive than bighorn sheep. And so they push them out of the areas.
So at what point, you mentioned the idea of burrow removal, at what point did that become the policy or become something that people became concerned about and started thinking about and acting on trying to get rid of some of these burrows?
Burrow removal was almost immediately a concern in the Grand Canyon. So we had the establishment of the National Park Service in 1916, and the first director of the park, Stephen Mather, he, in 1920, called the burrows evil and called for their removal pretty much immediately. Burrow culling began annually in 1924, and no one really paid any attention to it. So the park just went in and hired hunters every year to go in and shoot as many burrows as possible. The population always remained, but that was pretty much the policy from the beginning.
Was the goal to really eradicate burrows there? Or was it just a matter of there are too many of them, maybe we just need fewer of them?
A bit of both. It wasn't till later that the idea of full eradication even seemed possible. In the 20s and 30s, the idea was just to keep the populations low, keep them away from the main trails. And part of the really interest in removing burrows is because they weren't interesting. The park wanted tourists to come to the Grand Canyon and see bighorn sheep and mule deer and elk, and burrows were just boring. So it was at least to keep the population low enough that they didn't interfere with tourism.
Huh. What about them was so boring? I'm curious what attributes make a burrow boring?
Well, it's so interesting because we then see later on people are much more interested in burrows because for us and by like the 70s and 80s, they're not commonplace. You don't see burrows all over. But in the 20s and 30s, they were just the lowly burrow. They were the pack animal. They were the beasts of burden. So it wasn't as exciting as seeing exotic two peoples wildlife.
Ah. So obviously, you know, some number of years later, there's sort of a role reversal where the call is not to eliminate all the burrows, but maybe to stop trying to eliminate all the burrows at Grand Canyon. What led to that sort of shift in philosophy?
Well, so the National Park Service never shifted there. They planned to get rid of the burrows from the beginning and never really wavered. The main change was that people started paying attention. In the early years, it was easy to never even notice the burrow hunts and not really pay attention. But by the 60s, you have this rising interest in environmentalism and at the same time, growing interest in animal advocacy. So you have these different groups that all of a sudden are paying attention to the environment and the animals. And specifically in the 60s, a huge lobbying effort for the what would later pass as the Wild Horse and Burrow Act in 1971.
So I've got to ask you about one burrow in particular who seems to have maybe played an outsized role in raising people's awareness of the situation of the Grand Canyon, a burrow named Brighty.
Yeah, Brighty of the Grand Canyon. He's probably the most famous burrow in the Grand Canyon, possibly in the country. He was a real burrow in the 1920s, and he lived in the Grand Canyon. He was probably an old prospector's burrow that got loose, and he lived a bit of a semi-feral life. He would come and let children ride him and walk around camps, but then if anyone tried to make him do real work, he'd run off. And he was just one of those popular characters of the canyon for a long time and was somewhat forgotten about until he was resurfaced by an author, Marguerite Henry, in the 50s, and she wrote a fictionalized retelling of his life where Brighty was forever associated with the wild scenery of the Grand Canyon and really shaped a lot of perception that went into whether burrows should be allowed in the canyon, because everyone pictured Brighty standing on the cliff overlooking his domain.
So what does the future look like for this animal in and around northern Arizona?
Well, as long as the Wild Horse and Burrow Act continues, they will forever be allowed to some extent on some public land. Now, that's always heavily debated on whether they should be allowed at all, whether they, as a non-native animal, should be removed. But as long as the act remains, they are allowed on the land. Now, the BLM does manage their populations and tries to keep them from overpopulating or overgrazing areas. So I don't think that we'll see a burrowless Arizona anytime soon.
Well, Abby, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was great.
Abby Harlow is a PhD candidate in ASU School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies.
Gotta love a burrow. All right, that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think and any story ideas you are seeing out there. We are at the show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.